My name is Sean, and I'm an alcoholic. And that's the end of the facts. All of the rest of this stuff is my opinion, and I'm not a spokesman for Alcoholics Anonymous. I'm not an expert on alcoholism. I don't speak for Alcoholics Anonymous. Nobody speaks for Alcoholics Anonymous. This is the wonderful thing about Alcoholics Anonymous is it's a program without dogma. We all just share our own experience. There are no experts here. There's no popes in Alcoholics Anonymous, although there are a few guys kind of getting ready for the job if it ever comes open, you know, but... So I'm just going to tell you a little bit about what it used to be like, what happened, and what it's like now. I want to thank you for inviting me to this. I mean, this must be the center, huh? The Mystic Knights of Sobriety. I've been looking for the cult, you know, for a long time, and who knew they were caterers? This is great. Can you imagine taking a newcomer? We're going to take you to a meeting. The Mystic Knights of Sobriety. Ah! Your worst fear. This is wonderful. I want to thank Rick for asking me and Jack for hosting me. The first thing you do in Edmonton is buy cowboy boots, right? So that's where he took me, and I bought some cowboy boots. Walk around in Vancouver, they smile at me. You must be from Alberta. So this is 73 years. Wow. Well, when those two old farts met, huh? Isn't that incredible? I've been doing this kind of stuff, this kind of talking stuff for 24 years now. I've been what is known as a circuit speaker. Let me tell you, I know what it is. It's the least important 12-step work there is. It's real easy for me to stand here and blab and look good and get on a plane and go back to Vancouver and UNIDAC never actually see me in traffic. I had to take the honk if you're a friend of Bill W. off my bumper because my driving is so... Oh, anyway, the most important 12-step work, of course, is, you know, the stuff that you're doing, you know, the... One drunk talking to another while the other one pukes on your shoes. You know, that one-on-one getting somebody sober, talking them through the first night, taking them to the first meeting and getting through the first couple of days. That's the most important work there is. The incredible thing about this is that it's not speaking, it's sharing, so there's no performance involved. And I'm only here, you flew me here to talk to share with one person in this room, and usually you never find out who that is. Sometimes you do, but most of the time you just never know who it is. And so it's been a wonderful experience for me. But I was asked to share a Founders Day a couple of years back, and it's kind of a weird thing, Founders Day, because you know they're selling T-shirts out of Dr. Bob's basement, you know, which is weird. And Dr. Bob must be spinning in his grave in Akron for Founders Day. And then they had just opened the guest house, where the two dudes met, and Henrietta Seiberling's guest house. And they just opened it up for Founders Day. And so we all went, you know, of course I had to see it. And it's about as big as this platform here, this little guest house. And so you all had to line up, you know, to get into it, to go through it. And while you're online, and it was like Disneyland, you know, it was one of those snaking lines. They had little speakers with Henrietta Seiberling's disembodied voice talking about the first meeting. I mean, it was very strange. But the interesting thing is when you get into the house, you look across like three football fields of lawn. And at the back of it is this huge English manor house. It looks like Hampton Court, you know. And I can just see Bill Wilson, you know, 6 months sober, looking across the thing. Whoa, we've hit it. And the room that they talked in is about this big. And literally, it has room for two chairs. They were literally knee to knee. And knowing how Bill Wilson was, Bill Wilson could have sold snowballs to Eskimos. And, I mean, he had Dr. Bob trapped in this little room for 3 hours. Dr. Bob would have agreed to anything, I'm sure. You know, just get me the hell out of here with this nutcase in my face. And so it was really fun to see all that kind of stuff. But 73 years, it's hard to believe that 74 years ago, guys and women like you and me couldn't have gotten sober. We had no place to go. That's not a long time. We are part of what is basically the third generation. Those of us who have got, 25 to 35 years, we're kind of the third generation of Alcoholics Anonymous. You know, and the third generation in any family business tends to screw it up. And thank God for the traditions, and thank God for the old timers. But we gotta be careful about what we're doing, because we're passing it on to the fourth and fifth and sixth and seventh generation. And I think it's really important that the message is not diluted, that we understand what our signal is of purpose is, and that in some way we can always keep going back to the basics, the basic thing of one drunk talking to another. Nowadays, we think a 12-step call is driving somebody to a treatment center, but that ain't it. It's me sharing my experience, strength, and hope with you. I was born in Victoria, British Columbia. And all I wanted out of that town was out. My father was a drunken sailor, and my mother was a saint. I've come from a large Irish Catholic family, so, alcoholism is largely unnoticed in our society, it's just simply the element that we live in. It's like goldfish trying to describe water. I mean, occasionally there were the ones that had the failing. He has the failing. I had a great Uncle Joseph, who was my great Aunt Mary's brother, and he used to walk through this huge house. I've never heard him speak in the entire time. He never said a word. He'd just walk through the house and go down the basement where he had a home brew. And he would stay down there, and occasionally there'd be like gunshot sounds coming from the basement, but it was just a batch that blew off the tops, Unbelievable. So anyway, drinking was just something we did. I don't remember my first drink. I have no idea when my first drink was, but I do remember my first drunk. I was 14 years old, and by that time, puberty was hitting, and I don't know about you, but I puberty didn't feel good to me, so I skipped it. I just got drunk, and sailed through it as best I could. The first night I blacked out, I threw up, and I could hardly wait to do it again. And I did it every chance that I could. And by the time I was 17, I discovered the wonderful world of chemistry. I started raiding my parents' medicine cabinets, and that was fun. And by the time I was 18 years old, I said the phrase that only an alcoholic says. And if you've ever said it, you're a drunk. If you've ever heard somebody say it, you're listening to a drunk. And that phrase is, I can control my drinking. I said that when I was 18 years old. I had been getting drunk for 4 years. I'd been taking drugs for a year, and I was in trouble with the chemicals. But the idea of living without them, without something to kind of cushion what I perceived as an ever-increasingly hostile world, was impossible for me at that point. I had become addicted. I didn't know it. So I started the great obsession of every abnormal drinker to control and enjoy my drinking. Now, I don't know about you, but I never got control and enjoy in the same room at the same time, ever, ever. I mean, when I was controlling my drinking, I was miserable. The only way I've ever enjoyed my drinking is wildly out of control. I mean, I just want you to know that I am a 3 a.m. stark naked howling at the moon drunk. That's what I am. I'm noisy. I describe myself as kind of the suicide bomber of drinking. When I blew myself up, I took a lot of people with me, I did a lot of damage to a lot of people. You got into a lot of trouble if you had a little drinky with me, because we were liable to end up tattooed and in jail. But I always had this kind of, you know, this kind of sweet Irish face, and I could talk my way out of more things than I unfortunately did. You know, if more people had just stood back and said, that's bullshit, I'd have been here a lot sooner. But I managed to do that. Our family moved to California. I went to San Francisco State University and majored in journalism and drama. And then I moved to New York to become an actor. When I was 20 years old, and by the time I was 24 years old, I'd appeared in several Broadway shows. I'd done some national tours. I was doing television commercials and all kinds of stuff. And I was drinking a quart of scotch a day, and I'd picked up a little non-habit forming marijuana habit. I was working the docks. Not the kind where the ships come in. Doctors. I love doctors. I love doctors. They're so stupid and they're so arrogant. And, you know, it's just perfect. You know, and they don't know how to say goodbye without writing something. You know? So if you give them the right symptoms, they'll write what you want. So one of my first investments was a physician's desk reference. So I, you know, went through all the meds and figured out, you know, oh my God, I suffered from fatigue. I suffered from insomnia. I suffered from weight problems. I suffered from being underweight. I suffered from whatever I could. And I went and talked to all three of my doctors, and they all three gave me prescriptions. And then we'd meet for drinks and swap pills. Here, you want to try a pink one? Yeah. Let me have one of your yellow ones. Let's see what that one does. You know. So I was in pretty bad shape. So by the time I was in my mid-20s, I was starting to go to moral superiors for help. I don't know if you did that. I went to doctors and psychiatrists and psychologists and social workers and, you know, gurus and spiritualists and priests and monsignors and nuns and policemen, lawyers, and judges. And some of them were very earnest and knowledgeable people, and they would discuss it with me what was going on, and then they would make the mistake of saying, this is what you should do about your problem. Well, anybody points a finger at me, I bite it off at the knuckle, you know. So I decided what I needed was a good woman, and I met her at an elevator, we started our dance of death, and eventually we ended up in AA and Al-Anon. I was living in New York, so I took an Actors Geographic, which is a national tour, and it closed in L.A., and we got married, and she settled down. One day, she was having a sip of whatever the hell she was sipping, and she said, this is boring, and put it on the table and never drank again. And then she noticed that I drank. A lot. And let me tell you, I didn't marry a teetotaler. I mean, nobody marry somebody who didn't drink. I didn't know anybody who didn't drink. She was a 10-martini what-the-hell girl, and all of a sudden she just stopped drinking. She didn't go through withdrawals, nothing. She wasn't an alcoholic. And there I was, way out there, way over my skis, you know, just crazy. I was kind of restarting a career in film and television, and in the meantime I got a real estate license and started selling real estate, and my life was just tipping out of control, but I managed to accumulate a lot of stuff so it didn't look like that's what was going on. I had a house in the Hollywood Hills. I drove a Mercedes. I had a pretty wife and a pedigree dog and a decent job and a little bit of a career. And I was well-dressed and everything looked great except that I was dying. And what was slowly dawning on me and becoming very hard-rooted in the bottom pit of my gut was that I could not drink, and that it was pretty clear that my life was ending, but I wasn't going to die. That kind of despair was kind of seeping into everything. You could smell it on my clothes, and I couldn't go to sleep without a little something, and I couldn't wake up without a little something, and I couldn't get through the day without a little something. And I mean, there were formulas and recipes and all kinds of combinations, and it all came crashing and burning down on me on April 23rd, 1974. I couldn't handle another Easter, you know, all that dying and hiding, and yeah, that was just the eggs. And on April 24th, I went to work, and it was a day at the real estate office where we had to go look at new listings, and it was my turn to drive. And I had been arrested the night before. I was dressed pretty much like this, only I had fingerprint ink. It's a nice touch, you know. And we were driving, and there was me and three women in my car, and they started talking about drinking. There was Mary. Mary was about 70 years old, and she was this adorable little Irish lady who drank three drinks a night her entire life. Every night of her life, she drank three drinks a night. And then there was Chris, who was going through a divorce, and she was drinking too much. And there was Suzanne, who was sitting next to me, and Suzanne had 6 years of sobriety. And Suzanne was having a hell of a good time. Suzanne laughed a lot. She made no bones about being in AA. She, you know, everybody knew. And I thought, that's a little tacky, you know. I come from kind of Scottish stock, you know, and you don't discuss your medical problems with people. You know, you just don't do that. You just tough it through. And so they wouldn't shut up about drinking that morning. And I was, I had decided a couple of years before that hard booze was the problem. So I became a wine connoisseur. Now, a wine connoisseur is a wino with a checkbook.
Yeah.
And I have guzzled some of the finest French wines ever made. Good color. Excellent bouquet. God. But oddly enough, about a couple of weeks before I crashed and burned, I switched to straight cheap vodka. And I was on about a 2 week vodka run before it all crashed and burned. So the vodka, which leaves you breathless, was kicking out of my liver that morning, and you could smell it. You know, that wonderful kind of alcoholic, that sharp, you know, that sharp thing that no amount of cologne can cover. And Suzanne was sitting next to me, and she got a whiff of it. And we got back to the office, and I took her aside. It was 11 o'clock in the morning on April 24th, and I said the last phrase. I said, I'm an alcoholic, and I got 20 minutes before I go to pieces. And that was absolutely true. And she heard the screaming, and she canceled all her appointments that day, and she 12-stepped me. She took me to her apartment. She sat me down at her dining room table. She got out the big book. She read chapter 3, chapter 5, and the traditions. And I thought, that woman's going to read that entire book to me. I don't know. And then she told me her story. Now, mine was sleazy, but hers was disgusting. I mean, whoa. Ooh. But that first glimmer happened. I thought, my God, if she cannot drink, maybe I got a shot at it. And she said, do you believe in God? And I said, I suppose so. And she said, that's good enough. She said, do you think you cannot drink for the rest of the day? I said, of course. And then I immediately thought, oh, my God, what did I say? So she said, fine, let's go to your place. So we jumped in her car and we went to my place, and she poured out all the booze down the kitchen sink. Now, I had explained to her that drinking was the problem, but I had psychological problems, and so I needed medications, you know. She said, listen, honey. In Southern California, we describe sobriety as clean and sober. And I said, what exactly does that mean? She said, that means we don't drink any alcohol and we don't take any self-administered mind-altering chemicals that affect us from the neck up. I was real disappointed at that news. And so she not only cleared out my booze cabinet, she cleared out the medicine cabinet. A great huge cardboard box of prescription medicines and a big bag of grass and some other things went out into the trunk of her car. She said, I'll take care of this, honey. So I couldn't go back to the garbage can and go through it, you know. So she took me to my first meeting, and it was exactly as I was afraid it was going to be. It was in a church basement. It was filled with smoke, and all those people I never would have drank with were there. You know, I mean, you. I mean, And it must have been a slow night for newcomers because they're real pleased to see me. Just, hi! Oh. It was like being dropped into a shark tank. You know, I've never seen so many teeth coming at me in my entire life. Hi! And he shook my hand and he wouldn't let go. Have you noticed that? They don't let go. You know, they hang on to you. And then they lean in and say weird stuff to you that makes no sense at all, you know. Keep coming back. First things first. One day at a time. It's like being stoned to death with fridge magnets. Jesus. And then you were touchy. Oh my God. But you know an odd thing happened at that first meeting? A thing that I mistook for a long time. I thought I fell in love with Alcoholics Anonymous the first night that I was sober, and that's not true. I've always mislabeled my emotions. What did happen at that first meeting was that I felt safe. I felt safe for the first time in a very, very long time in my life. I started listening to the meeting, and the meeting had that same buzz that this one had as everybody was coming in here to dinner, you know, and everybody was talking. Nobody listening, you know. And, you know, that buzz, that thing, you know, because we're all adrenaline junkies, you know. So, I mean, that buzz in the rooms was just electric to me. And I loved it. And then they had a couple of speakers. Now, meetings, and this was in Hollywood, California. Now, meetings in Hollywood are huge. The first three meetings I went to were 400 and 500 people each. They were like one-day conferences. All the meetings were like that. They were huge meetings, and they were all speaker meetings. And so the speakers got up and started talking, and they would tell their whole story, their whole lives. So you got all, I mean, I just started identifying like crazy. And gradually what started to happen is when I got up enough courage to tell you who I was, you never, ever said, this is what you should do. What you said was, I know how you feel. Well, as soon as somebody says that to me, it dampens down the anxiety enough that I can listen. See, I got a listening problem. I got a hearing problem. I don't hear what you're saying. I've always had that problem. But as soon as you said that, I could calm down enough. And then you never said, this is what you should do. You said, this is what I've done. This is what I've done. And I could take that. I could take it because it was your own personal experience. So it was true. It may be more true for you than it was for me, but it was true. And I couldn't deny it. So it was incredibly powerful, that sharing right from, you know, from where you came from. And I remember, my chips were a little scattered when I first got in. Now, like I said, I arrived at my first meeting dressed like this. Except more expensive. I had on a $250, this is 1974, I had a $250 sports jacket from Saks Fifth Avenue. I had Italian loafers, French gabardine slacks, a designer tie. I looked fabulous at my first AA meeting. I did. But there were a couple of things that were going on that I wasn't aware of. One of them was I had been drinking straight vodka, and I put on a lot of lemon-lime cologne to cover it, and I smelled like a gimlet. You know? And then I had newcomer eyes. Now, the only other place you see eyes like that, other than on a newcomer in Alcoholics Anonymous, is on a dog loose on a freeway. Yeah, I was just like... Because I didn't know what you were going to do, you know. I didn't know. I had, you know, despite the fact that she had explained everything that was going to go on, I knew there was going to be a song, you know, that we probably were going to have to learn a song. And there's probably going to be like uniforms, but, you know, like navy blue work shirts and navy blue work pants. And we'd talk about sobriety, and then we'd break up into small groups with literature and go out to bars and give it out like... And there might be hats too. There might be hats or a secret handshake. And, you know, I was so desperate that if that was true, I'd have done it. I'd have done it. I was so desperate. Alcohol and drugs had made me sweetly reasonable, you know. I was dangerous because whatever you told me to do, I did. And so you had to be real specific, real careful with me. My sponsor, I found the first night that I was sober, and he started shoving the 12 steps down my throat. I didn't get to study them. I didn't get to go to step study groups or anything. I just took them, you know. And so we started right off the bat. And man, it was weird. I'd come home from a meeting, and my Al-Anon would say, "Okay," she went to Al-Anon 6 days after I got sober and has been there ever since. And she would say, "What did the speaker say?" And I go, now, I'd just been listening to somebody for 3/4 of an hour, and I couldn't remember one thing that they said. Slowly but surely, if I could remember one thing, it was a huge victory. I could hardly wait to get home, you know. So I got my sponsor, he started the steps, and I was assigned a new best friend. And my new best friend was Rich. And Rich could not drive and could not talk, and I had a car and couldn't shut up. So... And my sponsor sponsored him, so we were now new best friends. He had 6 months of sobriety, which gave him the right to say anything he wanted to me. But if I commented in any way on him, he would say, "Don't take my inventory." It was just charming. Now, the first three steps were not a huge thing for me. I mean, the first step, you know, I could not drink. My life was over. I was not going to die. I mean, so the unmanageability of it was, you know, my life was unmanageable. My life was dribbling down my sleeve. I mean, I had the fingerprinting. You can't get that stuff off. Have you noticed that? Am I in the right room? I always look for the head nodders, you know. I thought those were the ones with brain damage. The ones that, you know. But those are the guys who would save my life, because I'd float something like that, you know, and somebody would go, and I go, "Oh, thank God, you know, I'm not the only one." We had a men's group in Hollywood that met in a park, and there was a lot of stuff going on in that park, a lot of drug deals, and one day we were standing outside. I still smoked at that time. We were all standing outside the room smoking. We're kind of looking into the parking lot, and this. This police car was out there, and they had this kid. He must have been 18 years old and doing some drug stuff, you know. And they slammed him over the back of the police car, and they wrenched his hands back, and they snapped on those handcuffs, you know, and you could hear it. You could hear the snack of those things. And I looked down this line, and there's like 30 guys going, my kind of guys. So I mean, the first step, please, you know. And the second step was, can you believe that a power greater than me could restore me to sanity? And that was that power greater than me kind of thing was getting kind of perilously close to God, you know, that God thing. And so my sponsor explained to me that somebody with 20 minutes more sobriety than me was a power greater than me. The Big Book was a power greater than me. A Room Full of Drunks was a power greater than me. You know, there were tons of powers greater than me, so just relax. And keep my mind open. So I did, and restoring me to sanity was a little difficult. See, I'm a nice upper middle class drunk. We don't go to funny farms. We don't do rubber rooms and paper slippers and no doorknobs on this side. We go to therapists. We talk about stress, and they give us meds if you tell them the right stuff. And so I was going to I was going to meeting in Hollywood. I mean, if you want insanity, you know, that, you know, some of those stories were incredible, you know. And I was a piker as far as that goes. But I had to pick Rich up for a meeting. We used to go to a meeting on Friday night in Beverly Hills. It was a very spiffy meeting, and you had to dress real nice and look good. You know, looking good was important. I'd rather look good than feel good, usually. And so we were getting ready. I had to go pick him up because he couldn't drive. And we had big hair in the 70s, really big hair. And Rich, unfortunately, was follically challenged. He, you know, so it took him a while to get the big hair look. You know, he had to kind of tease it all forward and spray it and then kind of bend it back. And, you know, get that Peter Lawford hair hat look, you know. So he was doing that, and he had a big old medical dictionary. And so I flipped it open. I decided to look up a definition of insanity. what else do you do, you know? So I looked it up, and it was a huge, long definition, a medical definition. But out of the middle of it popped a phrase that enabled me to take the second step. And this is it. It's a medical definition of insanity. Quote, a seeming inability to learn from one's mistakes. Let me run that by you one more time. A seeming inability to learn from one's mistakes. Wham. Nailed. You know, my entire life was slamming into the same brick wall over and over and over again, and I never bothered to look at how I got there. All I was concerned with was getting the hell out of there. My philosophy of life was a moving target is harder to hit. You know, so I never identified the causes and conditions that brought me to the place that I was in. And that clinically made me insane. So I'm in the second step. Bam! I was there. Then came the third step. Made a decision to turn my will and my life over to God as I understand God. I was raised an Irish Catholic as opposed to a Roman Catholic. And ours involves a great deal more wine. Yeah. So I went to St. Louis College in Victoria for 12 years, the Christian Brothers of Ireland. Not very brotherly and not very Christian. And I was taught how to be a man by men who had given it up. And they taught us learning by strapping us regularly, lining us up in cold places and beating the hell out of us. It was a wonderful way to learn. And I was listening to, you know, today about what's going on. I was listening to some of the descriptions of conditions that were going on in residential school. And I thought, when are they going to apologize to those of us who went to Catholic schools, for God's sake? You know. So anyway, my idea of God, which they taught me, which is probably not what they taught me because I told you I don't hear stuff right, was this big old dude with a beard who had a book who was writing down everything that I did or was thinking of doing. I mean, you couldn't get away with anything. If you thought about it, it went down in the book, and I was a thinker. And and because of that, I was going to be condemned to eternal fires while devils flayed my skin off with whips. But he loved me. I had trouble with that concept. You know, I couldn't quite make it work. You know, now that may not be what they taught me, but that's what I heard. So I largely abandoned that, you know, that concept in that church by the time I arrived in Alcoholics Anonymous, my spiritual life consisted of the two alcoholic prayers. The first one is, dear God, get me out of this and I will never do it again. And the second alcoholic prayer is, whew. That was my spiritual life, you know. So here I am faced with the third step. You know, God as I understand God. Now, I thought in order to take the third step, you had to get a handle on this God thing. You know, you had to figure out something. But what it was explained to me was that it was the big word in the third step is made a decision. A decision. The third step is a decision. And this is how I relate that decision. If I decide I want to live in a new house, I don't have the keys. What I do is I have to get a newspaper or go online and find a realtor and tell the realtor what I want, and we go look at a bunch of houses, and eventually we find a house that we like, and we make an offer, and there's a counter offer, another offer, and we eventually agree, and then I got to go to the bank and get a loan, and then there's the deed search, and there's insurance, and there's all kinds of preparations, moving vans, and all kinds of stuff. And what happens is I made that decision, but there's a number of steps to the point where I eventually get the key to the house. And that's what the third step is. The third step is I made a decision, not necessarily to understand God. What my search has been is to accept God, but to live my life based on spiritual principles. What are those spiritual principles? Then the next steps. They're all those steps that follow. Thank God they didn't tell me that was what it was, because it would have scared the hell out of me. So what I did was I said, okay, I'm going to keep it open here, and I'll buy this thing. Rich and I decided that we were going to get spiritual, and this is keen alcoholic thinking. We went to a midnight candlelight meeting in the middle of Hollywood at La Cienega and Robertson. Now, it was the craziest meeting on the face of the planet. There were about 50 people in this room, and there were two candles in the center. And so they would say, George is going to read chapter 5. So George would kind of crash to the thing and get it, and then he'd get down by the candle and go, rarely have we seen a person, and I'd get the giggles. And then as soon as I got the giggles, Rich would get the giggles, and it was like giggling in church. You know, it was that awful thing where we were really trying to be. And then these disembodied voices would talk about spirituality in AA, you know, actresses talking about, you know, being kidnapped by aliens. And I mean, it was nuts. And so we tried everything, because we were really trying to get this thing. And so we wouldn't sit together. And I'd sit on this side of the room, and Rich would sit over there. And then George would come to read chapter 5, and I'd hear him. And then I'd start to go. And then we'd get everybody going, because we, you know, because it was pretty funny. So eventually the secretary suggested that we find a more suitable meeting. So I'm one of the few people that's ever been asked to leave an AA meeting for giggling. Hey. So anyway, I proceeded almost immediately to the four step, because that little son of a bitch of a sponsor of mine turned on me and said, I was 3 weeks sober, and said, you have 3 weeks to do your four step. And he gave me a date when we were going to do my fifth step. Now, I didn't know that you couldn't do your four step when you were 3 weeks sober, that it didn't have, you know, breadth and scope and would make a mini series, you know. So I did mine, and it was 9 pages of garbage, and you know, and I did as fearless and thorough and everything else. And I said, how do you start? And he said, you get a blank piece of paper and you sit for 20 minutes in front of it every night. And I did that, you know, I did that. And some days I'd write 3 or 4 pages. Sometimes I'd write nothing, and, you know, but I did it. And 3 weeks later, I sat down with him and did my fifth step. Now, there's a lot of stuff in the big book that talks about, you know, going to a priest or a monk or the Dalai Lama or somebody to do your fifth step. And that was probably true at the beginning, 73 years ago. I mean, there wasn't anybody who was sober, for God's sake. I mean, you know, Bill Wilson wrote the big book and talked about the first 100 people. Well, there weren't 100 people. It was 40 people that he wrote the big book about. I mean, he was a salesman. And so, I mean, there wasn't anybody to take a fifth step with, you know, when they were new. So, unfortunately, that's gotten kind of landlocked in some areas. And I have a desperate need to be known. I have been an outlaw and an alien and an unwelcome guest and a stranger all my life, you know? And I've had this, I just wanted somebody to know me. And so I did my fifth step with my sponsor. I wanted to take a blind nun up the Amazon and do my fifth step and shoot her. you know. But I needed to be known. And so I did it with this guy. I did it with this guy that I'd known for 6 weeks, and that's not my way of doing things. You know, I didn't know him at all, and here I am spilling my guts. And an almost immediate thing happened in our relationship. First of all, the phone calls went from a half an hour to 10 minutes, because I didn't have to keep doing the backstory every time I talked to him, because he had all the information. And he also pointed out some causes and conditions in my life. He started connecting dots for me in my life. And I finally had somebody in my life who knew me. And almost immediately, he started using the information. He'd come over to me and say, you got to go talk to that guy over there in the corner, because he's going through a problem that you've been through. And I said, wait a minute, did you tell him? He said, no, you've just got the same experience. Go talk to him. And almost immediately, I got to see that that my deepest, darkest secrets, the things that I was going to my grave with, were now valuable, that they literally could save people's lives. Just to know that there was somebody else in the room that had gone through it, who was sober, was surviving, was doing well. You know, those kind of things were the miracles in AA for me. So we started almost immediately on the sixth and seventh steps. And, you know, I wrote down a list of, you know, we talked, and it became fairly evident what my list of shortcomings and defects of character were. And what I do with the guys that I sponsor now is when we get to that point and we write all those things down, what I do is I make them sit down and do a list of the opposites of those defects of characters and shortcomings. I want a list of what would be the opposite to those things. And when we got that list, we say, okay, now we got some life goals. Now we got some things to shoot for. This is who you could be. You could be the opposite of who you are. Because Suzanne said something that first day that dragged me into AA like a carrot in front of a donkey. She looked at me at one point and said, you know, if you stay sober and work the steps of Alcoholics Anonymous, it'll be possible for you to make a 180-degree turn as a human being. And I hated every square inch of myself. The idea of being somebody totally different was dazzling to me. And I came in here wishing to God that that would happen. And in a lot of areas, that has happened. There's still some sticky points, but there's a lot of that stuff. So what I do for myself and what I do for the guys that I sponsor is make them look at what the opposite of those shortcomings and defects of character are. And then came the eighth step. Now, I had, you know, writing a list of people that I'd harmed. Now, my sponsor pointed out that that's people I'd harmed, not people that I had annoyed. You know, because that list would be endless. People I had actually harmed, and so we did that list. And he added some, and he took some off. I mean, there's this lunacy in AA these days that I put my own name at the top of the list. Uh-uh. No. There's a whole lot of work that goes into this thing before you get to forgive yourself. And so we did the list, and I started on the ninth step. Oh, man, did I hate the ninth step. Now, the ninth step is about making amends. It's not about apologizing, because if it was about apologizing, it would have been a piece of cake. Because I am a world-class apologizer. If there was an Olympic event for apologizing, I would be a gold medal winner. You know, I'm the kind of apologizer that if I stole $500 from you and came to do an amends to you, an apology, I'd walk out with another $500. Yeah? But amends is a different thing. Amends is I got to go to you and say, okay, I need to talk to you face to face. And we get face to face. Emails are so much easier. Anyway, face to face, sit down and say, listen, as far as I remember, this is what happened. And this is my part in it. And I want to set that right somehow. Is there something we can do to make that right? And I also want to assure you that I am never going to do that again as long as I live. And you can watch me if you want. But I make that pledge to you that I will never do it to you or to anybody else again. That's some heavy-duty stuff. And I got to tell you, in the time that I've been sober, I've sponsored a whole lot of guys. And the ones that go out again are the ones who don't do the ninth step. The ones who refuse to make it right. The ones who refuse to take... Because the ninth step is I take responsibility for my condition. It is not my parents' fault. It's not the Christian Brothers of Ireland. It's not anything. It's not my chosen profession. It's not the people who hurt or slighted me. I am utterly responsible for my condition. I am utterly responsible for being an alcoholic. My father, who was an alcoholic, never suggested that I drink a quart of scotch a day. No doctor that I ever went to said, here's a prescription, why don't you abuse this? Those were my ideas. Those were my solutions to my problems. I can blame nobody. I am not a victim in alcoholics, as far as alcoholism. I am a volunteer, an eager volunteer, you know. And so what I got to do is I got to stand up and tell you that I have done damage to you and I'm willing to make it right no matter what it takes. And the guys who don't generally drink again. It's amazing. It's amazing when they come crawling back and say, how are you doing on the ninth step? You know. And I got to tell you, about halfway through it, literally those promises started coming true. You know, those promises that they read, those are not fairy tales. That started coming true. I started feeling not better than or less than. I started feeling like I wasn't a stranger. I started feeling like I wasn't an alien or an unwelcome guest. I was starting to feel like I belong here, you know, that it was okay for me to walk through this life. And the ninth step was miraculous for me. And then come the 10th and 11th and 12th step. Now, the 10th step, Irish Catholic, you know, if I, on a daily basis, if I go over and say, what did I do right and what did I do wrong? I beat the hell out of myself for what I did wrong. And I was doing this and I was talking to my sponsor and he finally said, look, we got to find another way to do this. So what we came up with is I go through my day on a daily basis at the end of the day and I say, what did I do today that I approve of? And what did I do today that I don't approve of? And the stuff that I don't approve of, I set out to change. The stuff that I approve of, I thank God for having the insight to do it right, and then I let it go. And that's kept me in pretty good stead. It's kept me in pretty good stead. The 11th step is thought through prayer and meditation. Now, I know about meditation. I'm a child of the 60s, you know. You light up a big doobie, and you listen to some sitar music and meditate, you know. Rich and I, in our spiritual quest, at one point were in danger of being crushed to death by falling bookcases full of spiritual literature. We were in everything. And I kept trying to meditate, but I'm a busy boy. You know, I am a busy, busy guy. I got this head full of, you know, I came here. You know, the wonderful thing about us is, you know, they don't get us out there completely. I mean, they think we're terrific, but they don't get us. You know, they don't want us to be just alcoholic. They want us to be some kind of medical thing that they can fix. You know, well, you know, I came here with a committee talking in my head. You know, now if I, you know, any doctor with any knowledge of alcoholism or any ethics, which is a rare combo. Knows that you can't double diagnose an alcoholic in the first 6 months of sobriety. I was crazier than I'd ever been in my entire life when I was 6 months sober. If I had talked to a professional, they'd have put me away forever. You know, but I'd go to an A meeting and talk about it, and somebody would go, Oh, yeah. Yeah, well, you just keep coming back, kid. Don't drink the rest of the day. You'll be all right. Will they ever shut up? Oh, yeah. Incredible. 6 months sober, I was on. 6 months sober, I would. The only thing that I could think of to stop the voices was I would pull my car out on the Hollywood Freeway and scream. I'd just drive at 70 miles an hour and scream. You know, driving down the freeway, you know, to get them to shut up. You do what you can, you know. So anyway, the meditation thing has always been difficult for me until, well, the last several years I found a meditation that has really been wonderful for me. And if you're having trouble with it, maybe it'll help you. It's from the other big book. It's a phrase that I concentrate on. I break it down word by word, and it is, be still and know that I am God. And what I do is I sit in a comfortable chair. I don't lie down because that's called napping. Which I'd much rather do than meditate. So I want you to know that I talk a better program than I work. I just want you to know that. I mean, we all give ourselves hope, you know, and sometimes we're giving ourselves hope, you know. I hope the gap isn't too big, you know, but sometimes I'm a stunning example of Alcoholics Anonymous. I mean, sometimes I just shimmer with sobriety, you know. You could introduce me to your mother. Yeah. Mom, here's a member of Alcoholics Anonymous. Yeah. In other days, I don't drink. It's about as good as it gets, you know. In those days when I'd like to check into a facility and take a lot of Thorazine and make a wallet. Just sounds like heaven to me someday. Unfortunately, I've been stark staring sober out here for 34 years, whatever it is. Anyway, I take that phrase, be still and know that I am God, and I break it down. And be means just be, just, you know, allow whatever is going on in the world, the noise from the other apartment, my stomach gurgling, the traffic, whatever, be, and then be still, which is just stop. Just stop and allow myself to concentrate on breathing in and out. Be still and know. And what I do is I imagine my head and my feet opening up so that I'm embracing the earth and the universe and everything around me. Be still and know that. Just allow myself to float in that. Be still and know that I am. And what that is that's that voice. That's that voice that sits right behind my breastbone. Oh, I got some nodders on that. Right behind my breastbone, that voice that I've been ignoring and overriding and telling to shut up my entire life. And it's that voice that has always been right. It has never told me what to do. It has always told me. It has always cautioned me. It has always said, consider, think, take this easy. Let's do one day at a time. Keep it simple. Stay where your hands are. That voice. Be still and know that I am. And then it identifies itself. Be still and know that I am God. Because I believe what we're carrying around is a little microchip of God in us. It's what the nuns used to call the soul. They probably still do. I didn't hear it. But what it is the thing that connects me to you and you and you and you. And when we all connect, then it connects to a power far greater than ourselves. This enormous power. And so that's what I do on a daily basis. And then comes the 12th step, having had a spiritual awakening as a result of these steps. I didn't want a spiritual awakening. I wanted a spiritual event. You know, I wanted a burning bush or the wind blowing up my ass like Bill Wilson. You know, just woo, you know. Something that would slam me to my knees. Yes, you know. Hasn't happened in the first 34 years. But I did stumble on the spiritual experience, the appendix part two in the big book, that describes me precisely. That mine has been a slow awakening. That people noticed changes in me long before I noticed them myself. It was a slow acceptance and the ability to develop a God consciousness. And what has happened now is that I have a deep and profound relationship with a power greater than me that's none of your business, you know, and it's that personal to me. I found it oddly enough in the writings of Einstein. I love throwing that out. It sounds like I kind of regularly read Einstein. I was thumbing through Einstein the other day. Einstein was a fairly bright fellow, as you know, and he was in contact with a whole lot of other fairly bright people of his time. And in his diaries, he wrote that all the scientists and all the philosophers and all the artists and all the people that he knew were considered geniuses in their field, all of them would admit that at the very, very, very furthest extent that man could take any form of knowledge, just beyond that seemed to be a benign intelligence. And I love the idea of a benign intelligence. I just love that there's something just kind of keeping this thing rolling along, you know. And so that's helped me do that. Try to carry this message to alcoholics who still suffer, and I do that. We were talking at lunch. I haven't been on a 12-step call in years. You know, Canada with socialized medicine, everybody thinks you have to go to treatment to get sober. You know, I'm one of those ones that shook it out in the rooms. I'm one of those ones that, you know, was a little quick when I arrived here. I detoxed in these rooms with you guys. You know, they gave me half a cup of coffee. They would never give me a full cup of coffee because I was lethal, you know. But I was always well-dressed, you know, because I was always coming from work. I went to my first AA meeting and went to work the next day. Yeah. And I was about four or five days sober, and they asked me to read chapter 5. And I got up and read it, and I sat down, and the chair of the meeting said that that was the first time she had ever heard it read in one breath. A little speedy. And, oh, God. When I hate to do this. You know, it's kind of that old fart thing. You know, we used to walk 50 miles through the snow to go to an AA meeting. You know, but people used to have grand mal seizures in AA meetings. You know, they were kind of interesting. You know, somebody be like me would be up here talking away, and somebody over there would go and flip down on the floor. And then somebody would just stick a wallet in his mouth and call the ambulance, you know. And the guy would just keep talking, and, you know, everybody would just keep, it just kept going, you know. And but it was a wonderful opportunity because you were sitting next to your sponsor. He would go, "You keep drinking, that'll happen to you." You know. So I'm deeply grateful to all the guys who had grand mal seizures because they kept me sober one more day, you know. It was just incredible, you know. I got to go on a 12-step call when I was 9 months sober, and I went with Rich. He had over a year by then, so he was qualified. He was qualified. So the two of us, in L.A., you always went in pairs because you never knew what you were going to find in those apartments. And we were going to, and we stopped by my sponsor's place, and I said, and my sponsor said, "You know, there's a difference between carrying the message and spreading the disease." So I did what I do on 12-step calls whenever. I washed the guy's dishes, and I vacuumed his apartment, and I cleaned up, and put out the garbage while Rich was laying the program on the poor guy, you know. And then, you know, and then we'd take those guys, and we'd take them home, put them on our sofas, and take them to meetings and stick with them, you know, because we detoxed. One of the first ones I did, L.A. County Hospital would not take alcoholics. They just would not take alcoholics. So I took this guy who was dead drunk. I mean, whoa, was he drunk. And I took him to L.A. County, and they wouldn't take him. So I took him back out in the parking lot and stomped on his foot and broke his toe. And took him back in and said he's got a broken toe, so they had to take him. Yeah. He didn't feel it, you know. But we eagerly awaited those opportunities. One guy talking to another, trying to get sober. It was, and I mean, your whole body is electric when you're doing that. I mean, you know, every ounce of program that you got is just right there, you know, just trying to keep this guy from dying on you. And a couple of years ago, at 3 o'clock in the morning, I got a phone call in Vancouver, and it was the answering service from Vancouver Central office. And the woman who was the operator was really upset. And she said, "Can you take a call?" I think her name was Mary. "Can you take a call from Mary?" And I said, "Yeah." And she said, "I have called 18 people and no one would talk to her." And I said, she said, "I've got her on hold." I said, put her on right now. And I waited a second, and the operator came back on and said, "I've lost her." I'll never forget the sound of her voice. I've lost her. That's our responsibility. I hope Mary got sober. But 18 people were too busy or too tired or had no experience with doing it, you know, who passed it off. And the responsibility statement, I am responsible. And then to practice these principles in all our affairs, oy vey. It's real easy to look good and talk good and act good in these rooms. But you got to take it out of these rooms. We got to take it back to our bedrooms. We got to take it back to our living rooms. We got to take it back to our workplace. We got to take it back to our community. We got to take it back to our kids. We got to take it out there. Because that's the best 12-step work there is. I got to be president of the Chamber of Commerce in West Vancouver for a while. And you know, I'd be sitting at some nice dinner party, you know. The guy next to me would be belting back his sixth glass of wine, and this happened. The guy said, "Man, wish I could quit doing this." And I said, "Oh, yeah, I know how you feel." He said, "Well, you don't drink." See, in my community, I'm known as a guy who doesn't drink. I'm not known as a guy who can't drink. I'm known as a guy who doesn't drink. He said, "Well, you don't drink." And I said, "No, I don't." He said, "Well, did you?" I said, "Oh, yeah." A lot? Oh, yeah. For a long time? Oh, yeah. So, well, how'd you stop? I said, well, I'm an alcoholic. I go to AA. Do you want to go? And the wonderful thing is the guy's jaw drops. He goes, you're an alcoholic? Whoa. Whoa. That's the best thing we've done. When they have no idea that we're drunks. When they have no idea, that's fabulous. You got them, you know. It's fantastic. Now, I want to tell you how terrific I am at working this program. I don't know how many of you have been to Vancouver, but when you're going through Stanley Park, four lanes of traffic merge into like one or two lanes. It's a wonder to watch. People from California come and take pictures of it. They can't believe it. You know, but we're Canadians. We know how to line up, you know. And you merge, you know. You go, you know, one car in front of the other. Everybody knows, you know. Now, I have to tell you that I have a problem with small, skinny, blonde ladies in large, black SUVs. I don't know why. I don't know. They just make me crazy. I don't know why. And so I'm going through Stanley Park, and I'm driving my little car. It was a Honda at that time. Driving my little Honda, and right next to me is this giant SUV with this little skinny blonde lady, and she's talking on the cell phone. She's got a latte in one hand. I don't know how the hell she's driving this thing, you know, with her skinny little knees, I guess. And so she's driving away, and you know, we're coming up to merge time. No, it's my turn. And I want to tell you, there's nothing more terrifying than an alcoholic who's right. Coming up. And she's talking to her manicurist, I guess, and she won't move. And I'm right. It's my turn. So I roll down my window. I give her the international sign, you know. I have to reach up so she can see me because she's... And finally, she went, oh, you know, and let me go in. And that's when I said, thank God I took the honk if you're a friend of Bill W. bumper sticker off, you know, because I was a stunning example of Alcoholics Anonymous at that moment. You know, man, such a jerk. I mean, I am stunned at my amount of sobriety that I can be instantly a jerk. I mean, just boom, you know, it's just incredible to me. I thought by the, you know, I keep hoping that, you know, you go to enough meetings, you sponsor enough guys, you mop enough floors, you make enough coffee, you know, you serve as a GSR long enough, you do all that stuff that you get to reach a plateau, you know, we can kind of pull out a lawn chair and quit trying so hard, you know, kick back. Well, no plateaus in the first 34 years. That's all I can tell you. I still need to go. Honest to God, if I don't go to a couple of meetings a week, you know, what happens is I just shift. I just get over here. Nothing that you notice if you don't know me, but you start to bother me. You know? You just start to annoy me, you know? So I keep going, you know, I keep going to hear stuff. I keep going to hear, like, this 15-year-old kid got up to take her first year cake and said, my sponsor told me to be where my hands are. Now, I've been talking to guys for years about staying in the now, staying in the now. And I found a phrase that said it like that. Boom. Just, you can't get in trouble if you're any... If you stay where your hands are. I mean, if you're right here, you can't get into trouble, you know? So anyway, my life has been up and down. I want you to know that I got sober, and life has just been a piece of cake since then. It's been a series of miracles. And I just love it. I've been rich and I've been poor. I prefer the problems of being rich to the problems of being poor. They all got problems, you know. Being rich doesn't fix you or protect you. Being poor still sucks. I've had business failures and huge successes and done incredibly creative stuff and just had financial disasters, and I mean, it has just been what it is. It's been a real life. I mean, I've skin cancer, heart attack, you know, all this stuff, you know, everything, and great times, and you know, just unbelievable. But it's I'm tiring. I wear people out. I'm exhausting. And so a couple of years ago, me and the Al-Anon got a divorce, and we decided not to wait until the children were dead. And we just kind of looked at each other at one point and said, you know, why are we doing this? I mean, we don't need to do this anymore. And I said, yeah, you're right. So so we split up. And we had been together 37 years. And so it's been a new thing for me. It's been incredible. I thought it was going to be really kind of awful. I mean, you know, here I am, a newcomer's worst nightmare, you know, old, sober, and alone. Yeah. And I'm loving it. I'm having a great time. You know, it's just, it's fantastic. I mean, it, you know, we did it with incredible dignity, me talking to my sponsor, her talking to her sponsor. We negotiated it all, you know, with an arbitrator. We managed to get through it with, you know, with pretty much our dignity intact, and we certainly wish each other the very best in our lives. Do we have lunch frequently? No. So I have a sponsor. I have an incredible sponsor. His name is Milt, and Milt has Alzheimer's, and I never get away with saying that. he was at my first meeting, and he moved to Vancouver 16 years ago, and he's been my sponsor ever since, and he's the man, he's the go-to guy, and now when I go there, he's not there, and it's tough. I take him out for a drive, and we go eat lunch, and we meet for an hour and a half, and we have like this looping conversation that goes, you know, it keeps coming back. Every 15 minutes, it's made a complete circle. But we have, you know, this program is miraculous. He knows what's happening, and I know, you know, and he's got this incredible, you know, I can't remember anybody's name. I never could. And so we'd see somebody, and he'd say, I can't remember the name. I said, I can't either, you know. And I say, you got an excuse. You got Alzheimer's. I'm just stupid. You know. So we laugh a lot about it. But he decided a little while ago that I should date. Oh, yeah. Now, I thought, you know, he's got Alzheimer's. He'll forget about this. Yeah. Date? So, he gets stuck on things. So he got stuck on me dating. So he drove me crazy about it. He said, you got to get out there and you got to, you know, you just got to, you know, start again. And I said, but, you know, but I want to be an old fart in AA. That's what I want to be. You know, I want to be one of those old dudes. I don't know. When I first got sober, you know, if you said, well, you know, I was watching Oprah the other day and somebody back there would say, outside issue. You remember those guys? They used to, yeah. I love those. They used to scare the hell out of me, you know. Outside issue. You had to be really talk about the big book or that was it. You know, maybe a pamphlet or two, but oh. And then, you know, those old parties. I spilt more of my tie than you ever drank, you know. And I've always wanted to say, madam, that is the ugliest baby I've ever seen. You know, I just want to be one of those cantankerous old farts in AA. You know, just, you know, goddamn whippersnapper, newcomer, don't know a goddamn thing. You know. So I was telling Milt that that's what I want to do. That's what I've decided to do is become an old fart in AA. And he said, no, you're going to date. So so I was doing this project, and there was this, you know, very nice lady. She was in her 50s, you know, age appropriate. And she was divorced and had a grown daughter, and I'm divorced and have a grown daughter. And we had some business stuff that we had to discuss. So I said, well, why don't we grab a sandwich? So we grabbed a sandwich and we talked about the business stuff. And then, you know, I walked her to her car and then, you know, we split the bill and this qualifies. So I called Milton and said, I did it. I had a lunch date. And I thought that would do it, you know. That. And at 3 o'clock the next morning, she called me dead drunk to find out if I was interested in her. And I said, not at this moment. But why don't we talk in the morning? Well, we had some business stuff in the morning. She didn't remember making the phone call, you know. So we got to skate over that. But I said, you know, I haven't dated since 1969. You know, there was Chappaquiddick, the moonwalk, and my last date. You know, that was it. I have no idea how to date. I mean, what the hell is that? I mean, I have never dated anybody unless I was dead drunk. My idea of a great date is somebody who will drink like a pig until 3 o'clock in the morning and then turn into a pizza. You know? Yeah? I mean, in my ideas of dates are you come to and you're laying next to it. And you don't know who it is. Or what it is. Or what you promised it. Or what you did with it. Or whether you're at its house or your house and you got to get out of there without waking it up. You know, that's hard on a humid summer morning with a cheap vodka hangover, you know? You gotta get out of there. You know, and one day you come to and it's awake. And it's looking at you. And you look into its eyes and realize you become its it. You know? So that's my dating experience, you know? And I mean, dating these days is complicated. I mean, it is complicated. I mean, you got to have doctor's reports and legal waivers, you know, who's going to get the distribution funds from the sex tape, you know. I mean, there's all kinds of, you know, it's complicated, you know, and I got to tell you, I mean, you know, there hasn't been a party in my pants for a long time. I'm almost 66 years old, for God's sake, you know. And you know, it's kind of like Tierra del Fuego. It's down there, but who cares, you know? So I mean, you know, if it gets up close and personal, I'm in trouble, you know. Now, I haven't had any mind-altering chemicals that affect me from the neck up, so I'm not going to mess with anything that affects me from the belt down, you know. The little blue pills. I mean, I'm an alcoholic, you know. If one of those little blue pills works, wonder what five will do. Yeah. Woo-hoo-hoo! They'd find me 2 weeks later dead in a gutter underneath my own tent. I don't know. It'd have to be an open casket affair because I couldn't get the lid shut. So I've decided to become an old fart in AA. So I discussed this with my sponsor and he thought it was probably a good idea too. You know? That's what I'm a outside issue. I like that. I'm liking that. But did you hear that? Did you hear what we just did? Did you hear what we just did? We laugh at the bad stuff, and we cry at the good stuff, and we call it AA. I tell you my deepest, darkest secrets. I tell you the stuff that I'm scared of. I tell you the stuff that I got that are reasons to drink. And you say, I know how you feel. You laugh with me, not at me. And some of you will probably come up and tell me what you've been doing. And that's why this thing is so attractive to me that I keep coming back. I keep coming back because this room and all the rooms like it are filled with healing, are filled with people that share their experiences absolutely from the bone and from the gristle and from the gut and from the soul and from the heart. And it is intoxicating. I'm as addicted to Alcoholics Anonymous as I ever was to anything. I keep coming back because it's worth it. I keep coming back because I give a damn and you give a damn. And I keep coming back because life doesn't stop. I keep coming back because I got problems that are probably as complicated as ones that I came in with. Different ones. As I grow older, they get different. But life still has got challenges and hurdles and stuff we got to do together. And so it makes it worth it. There's a pamphlet called The Member's Eye View of Alcoholics Anonymous. If you're new, get this pamphlet. It is an extraordinary piece of literature. It's probably the best piece that I've ever read. It was written by a man named Alan McGinnis. Alan McGinnis died just before I got sober in Southern California. He had a huge influence over the kind of sobriety there was in Alcoholics Anonymous. At that time, in 1974, what were emerging were there were three people that coalesced and kind of affected Western sobriety. There was Chuck C. Chuck Chamberlain had an extraordinary way of easing you into the spirituality of the program. He had a way of explaining a spiritual life that saved thousands of lives. Get his tapes, get his book, read him. He's incredible. The other man who has the most incredible understanding of the dynamics of the disease and also the dynamics and the actions to take as far as sobriety goes is Clancy. Now, Clancy is still around, and you can hear him, and he is extraordinarily intelligent and articulate and knows exactly what he's talking about. And the other man who understood the emotional content of sobriety was Alan McGinnis. And Alan McGinnis wrote this pamphlet. If you get a chance, read it. I want to read something to you. You know, if you're new and you don't understand what this thing is, how it works, in the southern states in Alcoholics Anonymous, and you know the like Texas and Oklahoma and all the southern states, when somebody gets up to a podium to identify themselves, what they do is they say something like this: "My name is Sean, and I'm an alcoholic, and by the grace of God, by the grace of a loving God, the big book of Alcoholics Anonymous, the 12 steps, the 12 traditions, strong sponsorship, sponsoring other people, being of service. It has not been necessary for me to have a drink of alcohol or to ingest any mind-altering chemicals that affect me from the neck up since April 24th, 1974. And for that, I'm deeply grateful." And that's got the whole thing. That's the whole package. Now, I just want to read you something that I like to end with because it's really... I think it's a beautiful piece of writing. I am not a Christian. I have never returned to the church that I was born with. I've never returned to any kind of organized religion. I've set out on a spiritual path that was largely mapped out by men and women like you, and I've found an enormous peace and an enormous comfort and an enormous acceptance of a power that I don't understand at all. But this. Has some Christian references, and if that puts your teeth on edge, just listen with your heart. "This coming Sunday in the churches of many of us, there will be read that portion of the Gospel of Matthew which recounts the time when John the Baptist was languishing in the prison of Herod. And hearing of the works of his cousin Jesus, he sent two of his disciples to say to him, 'Art thou he who is to come, or shall we look for another?' And Christ did as he so often did. He did not answer them directly, but wanted John to decide for himself. And so he said to the disciples, 'Go and report to John what you have heard and what you have seen. The blind see, the lame walk, the lepers are cleansed, the deaf hear, the dead rise. The poor have the gospel preached to them.' Back in my childhood catechism days, I was taught that the poor, in this instance, did not mean only the poor in a material sense, but also meant the poor in spirit, those who burned with an inner hunger and an inner thirst, and that the word gospel meant quite literally the good news. More than 34 years ago, Suzanne maneuvered me into AA, and tonight if she were to ask me, 'Tell me, what did you find?' I would say to her what I say to you now. I can tell you only what I've heard and seen. It seems the blind do see, the lame do walk, the lepers are cleansed, the deaf hear, the dead rise, and over again, in the middle of the longest day or the darkest night, the poor in spirit have the good news told to them. God grant that it may always be so. Thank you for my sobriety.